This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello everyone, welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 165, The Syrian War. In the last episode, we covered the Phratarakas, a dynasty of local rulers in Seleucid Persis, and their relationship with the empire's rulers, as well as some of the debate behind their place in Seleucid history. That was part of the larger tour of the empire that I am trying to weave into the story of King Antiochus III. Before the Phratarakas, I explained some of the provinces of southern and western Iran, as well as Antiochus's war against Molon, the rebel satrap of Media, and Artabarzanes, the king of Atropatene, who surrendered to become a Seleucid vassal. Before marching off to war with Molon, Antiochus and his empire were being pulled apart at every frontier. His cousin Achaeus reconquered most of Anatolia from Pergamon, but then declared himself king while Antiochus was in the east. Between his coronation and that campaign, Antiochus had started a war with Ptolemy IV of Egypt on the dubious advice of the Seleucid prime minister Hermaeus. Antiochus didn't have much progress on his southern front before turning around and heading to Media, but technically, he had started the Fourth Syrian War and left the job of holding whatever gains he had made to his subordinates back in Syria. With Molon, his brothers, and Artabarzanes defeated, and new provincial governors installed across the remaining Iranian provinces, Antiochus returned to Syria with a decision to make. Would he march north and face Achaeus, or south to resume the war with Ptolemy? We don't know exactly what, or even if, Antiochus and his advisors debated, but ultimately they went south. Despite being a rebel claimant to the throne, Achaeus was ultimately a Ptolemaic proxy, being supported by Egypt in exchange for disrupting the Seleucid state. If Antiochus personally went north with the bulk of his forces, Ptolemy would almost certainly press his own northward advance. However, if Antiochus went south, Achaeus couldn't realistically go south himself. The Syrian Seleucus was no longer a soft target racked by revolt after Antiochus's victories in the east, and Achaeus was both being drawn into a war with Bithynia and facing renewed hostilities from Pergamon at this time. Antiochus and his armies prepared for war in the winter of 220 to 219 BCE, but not all of them made it out of Atropatene. One of the few highly respected people outside the royal family who got one-on-one time with the Seleucid king was the royal physician. In this time, a man called Apollophanes. And Polybius presents him as the instigator of this next plot, which is possible, but probably propaganda to cover up Antiochus himself planning an assassination. Apparently, Apollophanes told the king to take regular walks in the cool morning air for himself, usually accompanied by a handful of his highest-ranking counselors. Apollophanes spread the word of the plan to a few other nobles, and one morning, Antiochus got up for his walk and left earlier than usual. Everyone acted like they were rushing to catch up, except for Hermaeus, who wasn't acting. The other nobles led Hermaeus out of camp on the pretense of joining the king for a walk and drew their daggers. The prime minister went out Julius Caesar style, stabbed to death by a bunch of other nobles who saw him as a threat to their power and to the state at large. Back in Apamea on the Orontes, Hermaeus's family was arrested and sentenced to death by stoning, eliminating any risk of a revenge plot. By the time spring arrived, the Seleucid military had a much better plan and a stronger position than they had during Antiochus's first foray against Ptolemaic. Diogenes, the same noble who had arranged Antiochus's marriage, was placed in charge of a fleet while Antiochus led the army from Apamea to besiege Seleucia Pyrrha, once the Seleucid capital and primary port of the region. The city had been under Ptolemaic occupation for over 25 years. While Antiochus kicked the Ptolemies out of the Seleucus, he sent an army under Hemiolios into Coel-Syria to block the mountain passes and prevent the Ptolemaic army from breaking his siege. This was the same general who had organized the retreat from Molon's offensive. Seleucia Pyrrha was intentionally built in an easily defensible position, but the Seleucids still had allies inside the city walls, including in the Ptolemaic officer corps. So Antiochus assaulted the city from four different positions outside, with an agreement from his fifth columnists that they could orchestrate a surrender if Antiochus's army captured the port and suburb that had developed between the docks and the city walls. That part of the city fell quickly. It was outside the walls. And Seleucia surrendered, on the condition that the inhabitants go unharmed. Far from wanting to sack his own major port, Antiochus quickly arranged for the families that had been exiled to return now that it was under Seleucid control once again. When the news of this success spread, Antiochus received a letter from Theodotus, the Aetolian Greek that Ptolemy III had appointed as military governor of his Syrian territories. During Antiochus's first invasion of the area, Theodotus had successfully repelled the Seleucid king near Mount Lebanon. However, while Antiochus was in the east, Theodotus had been recalled to Egypt and briefly arrested. Outraged by Ptolemy IV's purge of his own nobility, Theodotus turned on his benefactor and offered his services to Antiochus. As a show of goodwill, Theodotus and one of his generals occupied the cities of Tyre and Ptolemais in Phoenicia on the Seleucids' behalf. Ptolemais was briefly besieged by Ptolemaic loyalists under a general called Nicolaus, but they retreated when Antiochus marched ahead of his main army with light infantry to break the siege in person. Seleucid forces quickly occupied the cities brought by Theodotus' betrayal, and the Greek mercenaries the former governor commanded joined the Seleucid army in a series of skirmishes and sieges to drive Ptolemaic garrisons out of the mountain passes in the Lebanon range. Along with these cities, Antiochus seized 40 Egyptian warships and plenty of additional materiel. This was seen as an unmitigated disaster back in Egypt, and Ptolemy IV started preparing for an invasion. The first time that had been a serious threat to Egypt in over a century. The Ptolemaic army built up at Pelusium, on the western side of the Sinai Peninsula, and began stalking the city for a siege. Polybius claims that Antiochus at least briefly considered the option, but called off the plan when it became clear that Ptolemy was ready for it. Instead, the Seleucid army marched up and down the Levant, accepting surrender from various smaller cities and methodically besieging any that resisted. All the while, Ptolemy IV was negotiating, both with his Greek allies and with Antiochus. He was attempting to convince the Greeks that he would continue supporting them in exchange for their support against the Seleucids. And he was leading Seleucid negotiators on a drawn-out peace process, trying to buy himself time. The Ptolemaic and Seleucid negotiators approached the table on very different terms. Ptolemy demanded restitution for the unprovoked invasion and conquest of his territory. Antiochus refused to acknowledge the war as anything but the rightful Seleucid occupation of their own territory, and both sides took this all the way back to the Battle of Ipsus in 301 BCE. If you don't remember that one, after the united forces of the other Diadochoi defeated Antigonus Monophthalmos without Ptolemy I's help, they agreed to partition Antigonus's territory between themselves. Ptolemy moved in and occupied Coel-Syria before the Seleucids could get there. This became a sore point between the two kingdoms, and was the root cause of now 4 Syrian wars. However, Ptolemy IV claimed that his ancestor had supported Seleucus Nicator's reconquest of Babylonia on the condition that Egypt would have Syria. The problem with that logic is A, Ptolemy supported Seleucus well before the Battle of Ipsus ever led to that partition, and B, no source describing the battle or Ptolemy's support for the Seleucids ever mentions that agreement. It didn't stop Ptolemy IV from making his argument, though. On top of that, Ptolemy wanted any peace agreement in the Fourth Syrian War to include Achaios as his own independent king of Anatolia. This was a naked attempt by Ptolemy to exchange Syria for a powerful ally in Anatolia instead, at best forcing the Seleucids to trade one territory for the other, and at worst, exchanging the more strategically valuable and established Seleucid cities of Anatolia for a long-term forced occupation of Syria. It would also legitimize a Seleucid rebel, something that Antiochus absolutely refused to do. Meanwhile, Antiochus spent the end of 219 besieging a fortress somewhere in southern Coel, Syria. Polybius says that it was a town called Dura, so it might be the Lebanese town of the same name near Beirut, but as I've said before, Dura is also just the Aramaic word for fortress, so it honestly could have been anywhere. For whatever reason, the Seleucid army was unable to fully encircle this Dura and cut them off. So the Ptolemaic general Nicolaus was able to continue sending supplies past the siege lines. Antiochus eventually withdrew for the winter, hoping to negotiate, but when it became clear that Ptolemy and his advisors weren't willing to concede, the Seleucids resolved to take the rest of the southern Levant by force. In 218 BCE, saw ship after ship of fresh supplies from Egypt arriving in Gaza, along with reinforcements to Nicolaus's army, while the full force of the Seleucid military returned with the goal of forcing any recalcitrant city north of the Sinai to submit. Antiochus and Nicolaus once again squared off in a series of skirmishes and maneuvers around the Lebanon mountains, fighting to secure various towns and mountain passes as Antiochus tried to establish dominance inland, eventually forcing Nicolaus's army to withdraw toward the coast. This allowed Antiochus to claim everything between Lebanon and the Euphrates, before approaching the Phoenician city of Sidon. Polybius also mentions that there was a naval battle between the two forces on the Phoenician coast, but he does not elaborate or specify where. Sidon was heavily fortified, but functionally cut off from Ptolemaic support at this point. So Antiochus encamped nearby as a threat, but did not attack. Instead, he marched south to receive the surrender of a couple cities on the Sea of Galilee. One city in the region, Atabirium on Mount Tabor, sent out a garrison for open battle on the mountainside, but was defeated. Another, Gadara, held out for a brief siege, but in general, most of the major settlements between the Galilee and Dead Seas simply surrendered on both sides of the River Jordan. This string of successes sparked a series of defections from the Ptolemaic army, including several prominent officers. A detachment of the Ptolemaic army encamped at Rabat Aman. Over time, the Rabat part was dropped, and it just became the modern Jordanian capital of Aman. The Ptolemaic forces there were raiding local Arab settlements, which had the dual benefit of driving many local Arabs to Antiochus's side, and giving him a fresh target. The siege of Rabatama was initially unsuccessful, until a captured soldier revealed that the city was supplied with water through an underground canal, which the Seleucids promptly dug up and dammed with debris, forcing a surrender lest the inhabitants die of thirst. 218 was a wildly successful year for Antiochus. He had taken the northern half of Ptolemaic Syria, and now controlled both sides of the Jordan River, with just a few isolated cities resisting on the limited amount of Ptolemaic support that could make it through by sea. When he paused for the winter, it was almost certainly with the intent it was almost certainly with the intent of preparing to take the remaining territory south and west of the river. But in that time, Ptolemy prepared an army. Egypt spent most of that year preparing for a powerful counteroffensive, while Antiochus was busy subduing all of Coel Syria. The Ptolemaic ministers hatched a risky scheme to recall as many of their troops as possible from garrisons abroad, leaving the Greco-Egyptian colonies along the Red Sea, Ptolemaic holdings in Libya, Anatolia, and Thrace, as well as their allied Egyptian islands, with only token forces, while the rest of the army returned home. They also sent out recruiters to scour the wider Mediterranean world for mercenaries. This brought in Greeks, Gauls, Libyan Amazighs, and Thracians, amongst others. These mercenaries were given new equipment and training by the Ptolemaic army and its Greek generals to serve as a well-drilled and effective Hellenistic army of phalangites, mounted lancers, and skirmishing peltasts, rather than a Hellenistic corps surrounded by warriors of various local styles. By the time they were done, it's hard to imagine that there was a single mercenary soldier between Iran and the Atlantic looking for work. Between Antiochus's need to reinforce his own army, Egypt, the ongoing conflicts of various states and kingdoms in Anatolia and Greece, and the outbreak of the Second Punic War in the Western Mediterranean, Egypt must have emptied its already drained coffers to secure so many additional troops in such a crowded market. So in the spring of 217, Ptolemy IV joined his own army for the first time and marched from Alexandria to Pelusium and then onto the town of Raphia, modern Rafa, at the southern edge of the Gaza Strip. Antiochus advanced down the coast from Phoenicia, at the same time receiving very little resistance and apparently occupying the city of Gaza without any trouble before continuing south to face Ptolemy. He encamped less than a kilometer from the Egyptian army, sparking frequent skirmishes between their scouts and foraging parties for several days before the Ptolemies finally gave in and prepared for an open battle. The sheer variety of peoples enrolled in both armies led to the fullest recreation of an Alexandrian army that we have seen in quite a while. From left to right, Ptolemy assembled a cavalry wing, Cretan archers, a phalanx of the Egyptian royal guard, fulfilling a similar role to Alexander's old hypaspists, a group of mixed light infantry, a phalanx of Libyan pikemen, the phalanx of Greco-Macedonian colonists and their descendants, a phalanx of Egyptian pikemen, a phalanx of Greek mercenaries, Gallic and Thracian light infantry, and another cavalry formation. Ptolemy himself would command his royal guard in the style of Alexander the Great, but 40 elephants were positioned in front of his position. Another 33 were positioned in front of the right cavalry flank, for a total of 75,000 men, 5,000 horses, and 73 elephants, according to Polybius. Antiochus took up a position on his own far right, directly across from Ptolemy, with almost twice as many cavalry, thanks in no small part to the western Iranian horsemen and mercenaries from the steppe under his command. 2,000 horsemen were arranged in a straight line with the rest of the Seleucids, but a further 2,000 were positioned at an angle so they could ride up and easily flank their Ptolemaic counterparts. To their left came Antiochus's own Cretan archers and Greek mercenaries, screened by 60 elephants. then the main phalanx of Western settlers, then a formation of local Arabs recruited during the Transjordan campaign, Iranian light infantry, settler light infantry, Anatolian javelin throwers, and finally another round of cavalry with 42 elephants positioned in front of the javelins, for a total of 68,000 men, 6,000 horses, and 102 elephants. The Seleucids were outnumbered, but only marginally, and they had a slight advantage in terms of mounted troops, both in the elephant corps and the cavalry. On top of that, Ptolemy's elephants were neither the Asian elephants that the Seleucids had imported from India, nor their more famous modern African cousins, the African bush elephant, which is the largest living land animal. Instead, Ptolemy likely used a smaller African breed, which wasn't as confident in battle or the face of their larger eastern relatives. Polybius is one of the few ancient authors we have to actually describe an elephant battle, though, so I will quote from his histories. "A few only of Ptolemy's elephants ventured close with those of the enemy. And now the men in the towers on the back of these beasts made a gallant fight of it, striking with their pikes at close quarters and wounding each other, while the elephants themselves fought still better, putting forth their whole strength and meeting forehead to forehead. The way in which these animals fight is as follows. With their tusks firmly interlocked, they shove with all their might, each trying to force the other to give ground, until the one who proves the strongest pushes aside the other's trunk. And then, once he has made him turn and has him in the flank, he gores him with his tusks as a bull does with his horns. Most of Ptolemy's elephants, however, declined the combat, as is the habit of African elephants. For, unable to stand the smell and trumpeting of the Indian elephants, and terrified, I suppose, also by their great size and strength, they at once turn tail and take flight before they get near them. This is what happened on the present occasion, and when Ptolemy's elephants were thus thrown into confusion and driven back on their own lines, Ptolemy's guard gave way under the pressure of the animals. Meanwhile, Antiochus and his cavalry, riding past the flank of the elephants on the outside, attacked Polycrates and the cavalry under his command, while at the same time on the other side of the elephants, the Greek mercenaries next to the phalanx fell upon Ptolemy's peltasts and drove them back, their ranks having been already thrown into confusion by the elephants. Thus, the whole of Ptolemy's left wing was hard-pressed and in retreat." Yeah. Elephants with armor carrying full towers of spearmen and archers seems pretty impressive at a glance, but that doesn't do you much good if those elephants panic and rout despite the best efforts of their riders. The age of using the great animals for raw shock and awe was long past, and instead of providing a defensive screen, the Egyptian elephants turned around and ran back through their own formation, allowing Antiochus to drive Ptolemy from the battlefield. But that was only one side of the battle. Further down the line, the year of preparing the Ptolemaic mercenaries to fight as a phalanx rather than in their own local style of warfare paid off dramatically. The Seleucid elephants on that side did not charge, and neither did their Egyptian counterparts, effectively shutting down that component of the battle. Instead, the Egyptian cavalry charged, circumventing the Seleucid elephant screen and surprising the opposing horsemen on their flank and in the rear. In a tale as old as this podcast, The Egyptian and Greek units, armed as phalangites, charged lightly armored Iranian and Arab troops on the Seleucid side, quickly overwhelming them as well. That just left the main phalanx on either side, with neither quite willing to enter a full charge. Both sides could see a massive success on one side and a crushing defeat on the other. But whether of his own accord, or on the desperate advice of one of his counselors, Ptolemy IV managed to split off from his own retreat and appear at the rear of his phalanx, calling on his soldiers to move forward and decide the battle in their favor. They charged, the two sides clashed, and the Seleucid phalanx broke. Antiochus had already wheeled around and gone back to camp, expecting a celebration, only to see a cloud of dust racing back towards his camp as the rest of his army retreated. He supposedly tried to pull the same trick as Ptolemy, riding out to inspire his troops and get them to turn around, but it was too late. The whole army had already given up the fight. As the biblical author of Daniel put it, "The king of the south marched out in a rage and fought against the king of the north, who raised up a large army, but was defeated." The Battle of Raphia was a massive, demoralizing defeat for Antiochus and resulted in titanic losses, totaling over 14,000 killed or captured. The only real gain he made was capturing 26 poorly trained pachyderms that he couldn't even integrate into the rest of his elephant corps. Between the loss of life and loss of confidence, the Seleucids retreated all the way to Antioch and sued for peace. Ptolemy reclaimed all of Coel Syria, returning the two sides to their antebellum borders and establishing a one-year truce, at least according to Polybius. But Syria remained at peace for over a decade afterward, so the specific terms might have been more permanent for the actual region of conflict. In the final shakeout of battle, Antiochus III gained exactly one benefit. Ptolemy agreed to give up his support for Achaios in Anatolia. The Ptolemaic Seleucid truce would hold, and Antiochus was free to treat his wayward cousin as a rebel without Egyptian interference. Ptolemy, on the other hand, had become the first Macedonian ruler of Egypt to truly arm and empower a significant number of local Egyptians, a fact which would eventually come around to consequences of its own. And it is actually the Egyptian side of things we'll cover first. Next time, I've got a surprise Meet the Neighbors episode, because quite frankly, we don't have time to wait on Antiochus dying to cover all of the foreign affairs we need to get to. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, Thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.